The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
They say life is cruel, but having a missing child, I think, tops the list, definitely. I can't not cry when I talk about it because, you know, sometimes it just feels like it just feels so raw, even though it was 7.5 years ago, you know?
Our children's safety and well-being are of the utmost concern to us, and it is unlikely that a single day goes by without a parent wondering whether their child is okay at any particular random moment, even if we are 99% sure of their current whereabouts. We teach them early about stranger danger, to be aware of their surroundings, and to keep a vigilant eye out for those who would do them harm. These days, we monitor their online activities, their phone use, and sometimes their location. Rules and guidelines are set, parental controls are placed on electronic devices and social networking platforms. We use any and all tools at our disposal to ensure that the encapsulated world we've created to keep them safe from their naivety of the evil that sometimes seems pervasive in today's society is foolproof. In our society, we bubble wrap our children. It's not difficult to fall into a comfort zone, to believe that we've done everything we can possibly do to protect our children. But even for all our careful planning and rigid smothering, perhaps sometimes we unknowingly take our children's safety for granted. Though our excessive care and constant worry may have us believe that their protection is completely in our hands, which is probably more likely when they're young than when they're freedom-demanding teenagers, it is doubtful that we can prevent depravity from striking when it decides to do so. On April 26, 2010, 16-year-old Alexandria Joy Lowitzer stepped off her school bus and disappeared.
My biggest thing is I always remember I was in a restaurant in Conroe, Texas, and I walked into the bathroom. There was a flyer that was hanging up right on the wall when you walked into the bathroom. It said missing Allie Lowitzer. I found that out. It was 2010, of course, when she went missing, and it was probably maybe 4 months after she went missing when I saw that poster. So I had no idea that for like 4 months she was just gone. And I saw her picture on the wall and it said missing, and that was the first time I ever called her number that was still saved in my phone, and there was no answer. And I thought this has to be a joke. Like, it couldn't be someone that I know that's just gone.
Alexandria, or Allie as she is known to friends and family, was born on February 3rd, 1994, to John and Joanne Lowitzer.
She was born in Pasadena, Texas. Yeah, that's where I was born and raised and where me and John met. And she was born in Bayshore Hospital in Pasadena. And she actually, her pre-K year, she went to the same elementary school that I did.
Allie, along with her older brother, Mason, grew up in the quiet suburban town of Spring, Texas, and just outside of Houston. She is funny, sweet, and charismatic, and is always described as individualistic and creative. Allie is a natural-born artist. She loved to draw, and her work is exceptional, It shows a mastery of detail and an apt understanding of method and medium. Her voice is also remarkable. Allie enjoyed singing and was a natural in choir class. She actively participated in sports and activities inside and outside of Spring High School. Allie, in fact, was very involved in the Girl Scouts at an early age, as was her mother, Joanne. This mother-daughter involvement kept the two close, as they remained until Allie vanished.
Well, she'd been a Girl Scout since the second grade, and her favorite part about being in the Girl Scouts was camping and fishing. Believe it or not, Allie loved to fish, and she was really good at it. As a matter of fact, the weekend before she went missing, we had been camping with our troop, and I have pictures of her with her little SpongeBob fishing pole, you know, with the fish on it. She had had that pole for years, and sometimes she would catch more fish than anybody else with that teeny tiny SpongeBob pole. She was proud of it. And softball, I think. She started playing softball, I think in the fourth or fifth grade. She loved it. I mean, of course, you know, what kid some days doesn't feel like going to practice and kind of whines about it a little bit. But, you know, she had so much fun when she got there. We were just about to begin tournaments in softball. You know, she was pretty excited about it because she had been catcher on her team for that season. You know, she'd always wanted to be catcher. You know, the whole year before, she had begged her coach and begged her coach, you know, to let her catch. But she never did catch in a game, but he did let her do some catching during practice. And she had gotten pretty good at it. She wasn't quite assertive enough. She didn't want to hurt any of the girls. But, yeah, so she was pretty excited about softball that year. I think it was the year before that she was up to bat, and there was, I'm trying to think of how many girls were on base. I think there was somebody on second base, and Allie hit the ball, and she was able to get on first, and then the girl on second had moved over to third, so that there was another girl up to bat, and I think the girl hit it in the left field, I believe. Well, Allie was able to get on to second, and she kind of stopped, and the coach was like, go, go, go. And so she was running towards the third base, and the ball had beat her to third base. So Allie turned around and ran back to second base. Well, they call it a chase down, where they were throwing the ball back and forth to each other to see who could tag out Allie first. Well, Callie was just bound to determine she was going to get on to third. So, of course, you know, the third baseman, she was standing on the base, and Allie was just going for it. She was just running as fast as she could, and she ended up elbowing the girl in the mouth on an accident because the girl had kind of squatted down, and she was wearing braces, so her teeth were kind of bleeding a little bit, and so the girl started crying, and then Allie started crying, too, because she hurt somebody. She was really upset with herself for that. So, you know, after that, she wasn't so assertive on, you know, trying to steal any of the bases. But, yeah, she had always talked about that. And, you know, she, you know, made friends with that girl really quick on the other team and, you know, just apologized. And, you know, every time we saw them at the other games, you know, Allie made sure that she said that she was sorry again and apologized. And now, Allie just had a big heart like that. You know, she didn't ever want to physically hurt anybody. You know, and she was that way about animals, too. I mean, gosh, we would probably have to have a farm if I let her bring home every stray animal. And there's a story about animals. I think Allie was in the sixth grade. I was at work, and, you know, her and her brother were latchkey kids because I felt they were old enough. And Allie called me really upset and frantic one day while I was at work. And, you know, I had to get her to calm down and take a couple of breaths so that I could understand what in the world she was saying. She was trying to tell me that there was eggs that a bird had laid in the smoker box of our barbecue pit. And Allie, every day when she'd get home, she would run out to the backyard. She would lift that lid a little bit just to check on that bird nest with those eggs in there. That day when she called me, there was a snake that had gotten into the barbecue pit and was eating the babies. And, you know, she was just so upset. And I told her, I said, well, go across the street and get Mr. Bruce and, you know, ask him to come over and help. But Allie would always tell the story of, you know, those baby birds, how they were her eggs. And, you know, and every time you could just see her eyes tearing up every time she would talk about it. Allie was also, she was learning to play the guitar, the acoustic guitar. She was a wonderful artist, you know, I remember from the age of, gosh, maybe two, when she knew how to hold something in her hand and scribble on something, she did. No matter if it was, you know, a ballpoint pen on my grandmother's dresser or if it was a crayon or marker on the wall. I've got pictures of her, you know, drawings and paintings with all kinds of different mediums, you know, from watercolor and crayons. And what was her favorite? Oh, her favorite was, what do they call it? Pastels. I think it's like those really soft crayons. Yeah, that was her favorite medium to use. And then her voice. She has a beautiful voice. You know, my I have two favorite videos that I was able to get of her. One of them, she sang the national anthem at a fundraiser for, I think, a children's home. I saw somebody on the internet asking for somebody that could sing, and I asked Allie if she wanted to do that. And she was hesitant at first because Allie was very shy. And I said, you sing beautiful, Allie. I was like, you know, all you have to do is just, you know, learn the words and, you know, go out there and sing it. And I tried to build her up a little bit and not have her be so shy, you know, about using her voice. And she belted it out and it was beautiful. And, you know, every time I watch it on YouTube, I still cry. She was a good kid. She didn't make perfect grades in school, but you know what? That's okay. I didn't either. You know, I knew that she was really strong with her talents. So that's the direction that I pushed her in. You know, I didn't harp on her too much. You know, if she had a D in one of her classes, you know, I told her that she needed to try to do better in them. And, you know, she did what was necessary to pass, but it was choir and art that she really excelled in. I encouraged her where I knew that she could excel. That was just me.
Allie Lowitzer, though certainly talented, intelligent, unique, and immensely adored by friends, was, in every practical sense, a normal teenager. Shortly before her disappearance, Allie began working her first job as a cook at a fast food restaurant, the Burger Barn, where it is thought she was heading after she was last seen walking from the school bus.
Allie went missing on April 26th of 2010, and it was a Monday. It was a typical day for us. You know, I got up, started getting ready for work, and she got up and did her normal rushing around, doing her hair and throwing on clothes to make it out for the bus. And while I was at work and she was at school, she had sent me a couple of text messages and called. And even though she wasn't supposed to use her cell phone at school, she was wanting to go to work after school. She had just started a new job a few weeks before that, and because she had just turned 16 in February, so what kid isn't excited about, you know, a new job, and especially, you know, it being in a burger joint? And normally, her grandmother was here at the house, even though she didn't live with us. She would be over here just cleaning or doodling or whatever, and she would take Allie to work when she got off the bus. So that particular Monday, my mom had plans to go and see some of her friends that afternoon and wouldn't be home in time, you know, to take Allie to work. And so that was Allie's whole deal. She was trying to talk me into letting her walk up to the Burger Barn. And
I never let Allie walk that far before. I mean, even though it's only a quarter of a mile from the house, you know, it's still, you know, it's walking out of the neighborhood, and she'd never done anything like that before. And I wasn't comfortable, you know, so I had told her no several times. And, you know, finally, you know, after telling her no, she called and she was begging and begging. She's like, "Mom, you know, I'm supposed to get paid and I want to get my paycheck." And she says, "I'll text you when I'm there, and, you know, I'll text you when I get home," and just assured me, you know, that everything was going to be okay. And I reluctantly gave in, and, you know, I told her, "Okay, you know, as long as you let me know when you're there." And so I only had like an hour or two left of work. And when I got home from work, I think it was around 5:20 or 5:30, you know, Allie wasn't here. So I sent her a text message and said, "Hey, you know, I guess you're at work, you know, let me know if you're working or if I need to come get you, or, you know, what time to come and pick you up." So I started cooking dinner and doing stuff around the house, and some time went by and she didn't text me back, which was really strange because Allie was always on her phone. You know, so I sent her another text and I'm like, "Hey, what's going on? I'm guessing that you're working and he's got you busy, you know, let me know something." And a mom, I don't think men really understand, but, you know, sometimes moms just know when things are wrong, you know, or something isn't going right. And when I didn't hear from her after a couple of hours, you know, I just started thinking, it's like, okay, you know, why isn't she texting me back? Trying to put my own mind at ease, you know, that everything is okay. You know, like trying to reason with yourself and trying not to overreact. And but there was just this feeling in the pit of my stomach that something just wasn't right. You know, I figured, well, you know, maybe he does have her working and told her not to be on her phone, or maybe the battery needed to be recharged or something. And finally, after, gosh, three hours or so not hearing from her, it was just before 9 o'clock, and I knew that if she was working, then she would probably be getting off at 9 and would need to come home shortly after that. So I just drove up there and, you know, was telling myself, well, I'm just going to park, you know, in the parking lot until she gets off, and then I'll tell her, you know, she knows better not to answer my text messages, and I was just going to reassure her that, you know, this is what you need to do. And so I drove up there, and when I pulled up to the front of the shopping strip in front of the Burger Barn, all the lights were out and the chairs were on the tables. And I looked really close inside and I didn't see anybody whatsoever. There were no cars. And, you know, at that moment, that's when I started to panic. And, you know, when your child isn't where they're supposed to be, you know, there's all kinds of things that run through your head. So I sat there trying to think of what I could do and where she would be. And, you know, I was still trying to put the crazy thoughts out of my mind and rationalize with myself. And, you know, tell myself that, no, it's okay, you know, she's probably just, you know, with her friend or maybe their boyfriend. Or so I started calling around and a couple of her friends, and nobody had heard from her. And I called her dad. He was at work, and, you know, told him what was going on. And, you know, at that point I had started to panic and I was upset like I am now. And, you know, he was always, you know, that little voice of reason in my head. He's like, you know, calm down, it's okay. You know, I'm sure she's somewhere, and, you know, maybe the battery in her on her phone just needed to charge or whatever. And so, you know, it was a little while later, he got off work, and, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, still where she could be and, you know, what can I do. And so I drove over to her boyfriend's house, because he had been over visiting the day before, and he was a brand new boyfriend, you know, just for a couple of days. They had been seeing each other, and he came over on that Sunday, and he was trying to teach her how to play the guitar. So I remembered where he lived, went over to his house, and, you know, he was shocked to see me. because he had been calling and texting Allie as well and couldn't get a hold of her. So then, you know, I started to panic even a little bit more because that's really not like Allie. You know, I didn't know at the time, but, you know, she would send about 4,000 text messages every month. And about that, it was a fairly new cell phone. She had never had a cell phone before Christmas. So if you take Christmas, by the time she went missing, it was just about 4 months where she had her cell phone. And we didn't have a computer at home. So I didn't think to go home and check the computer, you know, for anything because we didn't have one. I went home and waited for Allie's dad, John, to get there and decide, you know, what we were going to do. I think it was about 11 o'clock that night. We called the local precinct 4 and reported her missing. And there was a lady officer that came by the house. She came in and we talked just very briefly for a few minutes. It felt like and. You know, she asked a couple of questions and, you know, we asked her a couple of questions. And of course, you know, I was upset and she didn't really write anything down. She didn't take a report. It was nothing at all like you see in the movies where they're asking you all these questions and they're going to get right on it. And so, you know, I was kind of shocked when she was headed out the door and, you know, I said, well, what do we do? She says, well, call us when she comes home tomorrow. And I looked at her shocked and I said, well, what if she doesn't come home? You know, she says, well, just call us tomorrow. You know, like it was just no big deal. And I was just completely crushed that she wasn't going to do anything that night. You know, my child is missing and, you know, that nobody knows your child like yourself, you know, because I was raised that, you know, the cops are there to help you. You know, when you need them, especially when there's a missing child. So, you know, my perspective of law enforcement completely changed that evening. And, you know, that leads into the struggle that we've had for 7.5 years now with all branches of law enforcement, basically not, I can't say not helping, but not doing what they can do to help. I know that there's more that they can do. You know, I just feel like it's not their child, so Allie's not a top priority for anybody else but me. And I'm in no way a cop basher. You know, I am totally pro-law enforcement, but, you know, what I've learned over these past seven years, that there are good cops out there, and there are bad cops out there, and there are cops out there that just don't give a flip. And, you know, I've learned really quick that, you know, the ones that do care are the most busiest and the ones that really can't help because they're so bogged down with work. And, you know, the ones that aren't really there, you know, with their whole heart are going to be the ones that are sometimes involved in the corruption. The next day was kind of blurry for me. I don't know why my brain does this, but in traumatic situations that I have a hard time remembering what has happened or what is said. I know that me and John John went to work that morning, the next morning, and I stayed home. There was no way that I was leaving that house to go anywhere. You know, I started, I was really new to Facebook. So the only thing I knew I could do was to, you know, let some of my friends know that Allie didn't come home last night. And, you know, me and Allie had been active in Girl Scouts since she was in second grade, I think. So one of the Girl Scout leaders that counseled in downtown Houston had saw that Allie didn't come home. So she gave me a number to call to an organization that would be able to help me. That organization was called the Laura Recovery Center. And I had never heard of the Laura Recovery Center or really what they stood for. So, you know, I waited a little bit because I was still like in panic mode. I had no idea what I should be doing or calling or anything. I didn't know what to do because the police officer the evening before gave me no advice whatsoever. That part was very devastating for me because I just felt lost. After the spending the entire Tuesday calling and talking to people and my friends and family. And that evening, I called the Laura Recovery Center and spoke to a very nice lady named Dawn. And it was, I think it was either 10:30 or 11 o'clock that night when I called her, but she still answered the phone. And, you know, she basically, they call it an intake. She asked me, you know, the who, what, when, where, and whys, why I was calling her. And she said, okay, well, I'll be at your house tomorrow morning. And I was kind of like, not in shock, but I'm like, you're coming to my house to help, you know, because nobody else was helping us. Law enforcement surely didn't come back out to the house, you know, after calling that morning and telling them that Allie didn't come home last night. So now it's Wednesday and Allie had been missing 2 days. You know, I have a, you know, a search and recovery team coming to my house and, you know, not really understanding, you know, what they can do to help. She gave me ideas, you know, to, you know, we made a list of this, of a to-do things. So we started doing things, and I mean, honestly, without her direction, you know, I still would have been lost not knowing what to do. Because, it, you know, before she came into the picture, I mean, we made homemade flyers and put both of our cell phone numbers on it. And some of our friends on Tuesday had started taking them and posting them around. And we had all kinds of crazy people calling our cell phones, saying that they've seen her prostituting or they, you know, saw her at this restaurant 3 weeks ago, or, you know, they heard rumors, you know, at school and all kinds of crazy stuff. So, you know, anytime I'm asked by a new parent of a missing child, I'm like, don't put your personal phone number out there because you won't get very much information that's viable. Not that I'm saying that everyone is crazy, but that was very strange. We had people show up at the house and psychics and stuff. So that was an experience for a completely different show. Yeah, once Laura Recovery Center, once we got organized, she had me and my mother-in-law here at the house making different phone calls to different places and going over phone lists. I printed out Allie's phone records just for, like, I think it was just for the month of April, there was like 60-something pages of text messages. And with AT&T, because it was under my account, we were able to print out, you know, the dates and the times and the phone number that she was texting with. But AT&T, they don't back up their data. So we didn't know what the content of the text messages were. So we were able to determine there was a couple of people that she had been texting with on her ride home on the bus. And one of her friends, his story is that she was wanting him to come over and hang out after she went and picked up her paycheck, you know, and got back home. And he said that he told her no because he either had other plans or he had booked work or something. I don't remember exactly what, but he said that he told her no. And there was one of her girlfriends that she was texting. So yeah, I mean, we've got the numbers and the timestamp, and it was we were able to prove, you know, exactly what time all communication stopped on her phone, which I think was just a few minutes after 3 o'clock. When she got off the bus, the boys that got off the bus with her that live a couple houses down from us, they said that instead of walking with them towards the house, she walked the opposite direction and had stopped at the corner briefly and was texting and then turned to walk down a little street called Old Pike, and that would have let her out of the neighborhood. And that was the last time that anybody had saw her. If you look at our subdivision, the way it's shaped, there's one street that goes all the way around the outside of the neighborhood. It's exactly a mile if you clock it. So the bus, it didn't wind in and out of the streets. It just went on the outside. So it stopped right at the end of our street because we're only three houses from Knotty Post. The other boys that got off the bus with her, one of them was the fourth house, which is the one right past ours, and then the other boy was across the street, maybe five or six houses down. We have images from the school bus video, or surveillance, you should probably say. So we were able to see what kids were on the bus and then what kids got off at the same stop with Allie. And it was just Allie and the two boys that got off. It was a slider phone, you know, where it had like a full keyboard on it. But the way I had her phone set up is that I didn't have a data plan on her phone. So basically I just went and bought a phone and had a phone number put on it. So any data that she would have used, like internet wise, it would have charged me like $2 or $3 a minute. Our agreement was that she wouldn't do anything with the internet, and we didn't have Wi-Fi, you know, at the house. Nobody had Wi-Fi, I don't think. But I was able to monitor what she was doing on her cell phone, you know, because she was on my plan, and it would alert me anytime that I had any extra charges on there. So, you know, there was a couple of times where, you know, she slipped up and punched something on her home screen that connected her with the internet. But then she was like, oh, Mom, I'm so sorry. You know, I did this today. So I'd go online, you know, and I'd be able to see exactly how long, you know, she was connected to the internet. And it was just seconds each time that she would do it. You know, but, you know, you always hear about kids nowadays, they're able to hide so much from their parents, you know, with their phones or laptops or computers. And, you know, I wasn't that savvy enough where I would have thought that she could have been, you know, hiding something from me on her cell phone, because I really didn't really know what an app was. And, you know, me being brand new to Facebook myself, you know, I wasn't knowledgeable enough to really think of her being in danger, you know, being on her phone. Now, the internet, you know, yeah, I mean, there was all kinds of stuff on the news, you know, about kids getting being in danger and being, you know, on computers. But back then, I mean, cell phones were pretty much harmless. Not anymore. But then the numbers that we didn't know who they belonged to, it was me and my mother-in-law's job to call those numbers to see who they belonged to. And, you know, that was pretty nerve-wracking to do. I mean, what do you say to that person, you know, on the other end, you know, saying that, you know, my daughter is missing, you know, you were texting with her, who are you and what do you know? Yeah, that was an experience, definitely. So after that, it was 2 days later, they started organizing and doing ground searches. And it always brings back the feeling that, you know, my God, they're looking for a body. You know, what else do you think, you know, when there's a search recovery team looking out in the woods? But, you know, I had to focus on, you know, maybe they could find her backpack or shoes or something or her cell phone. So I tried not to focus on them, you know, looking for a body. They did ground searches for several weeks. You know, volunteers from our whole area, you know, came out and volunteered whenever they could. And, you know, I got to meet a lot of nice people through that, a lot of caring people. And, you know, on the other spectrum of that, you know, there are some really cruel people out there that, you know, want to take advantage of, you know, people in bad situations. So we experienced it all for being in that situation. But yeah, so you name it, in this investigation and search, we've done it. You know, to sum it all up, in 7 years, I have learned more in these 7 years than I would ever want to know, you know, about law enforcement and just life in general, because life, they say life is cruel, but having a missing child, I think, tops the list, definitely. I can't not cry when I talk about it, because, you know, sometimes it just feels like it just feels so raw, even though it was 7.5 years ago, you know. This is me. Anytime I, you know, do anything or talk about, you know, the investigation or Allie, you know, I can't help myself. Thank you.
If you have any information about the disappearance of Alexandria Joy Lowitzer, please contact the Harris County Sheriff's Department at 713-967-5810. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, part 2 of the disappearance of Allie Lowitzer. Please visit alexandrialowitzer.com to learn more about Allie and to donate to the efforts to find her. And head over to Facebook and look for Hope for Allie, Alexandria Joy Lowitzer, to keep up to date on the events and explore Allie's life through photos and memories from Joanne. Please help Joanne get the word out by sharing Allie's flyers on the Facebook page. We'd like to say thank you to Bethany Ryan for her contribution to this episode. And, of course, a huge thank you to Joanne Lowitzer for everything she has provided us with. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Allie's story with friends, or stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using at Gone Cold Podcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the cases we cover and others. We also post pictures, so please join in. If true crime is your thing, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. There you can read about many cases, and they're always well presented and the insight always fantastic. Thetruecrimefiles.com never disappoints. And finally, we present a promo from our friend and fellow cold case podcaster, Christina. Her podcast is called Cold Traces, and it's amazing, as is her passion about the subject matter and sensitivity to the victims and their families. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hey, true crime fans. I'm Christina, and I'm the host of the podcast Cold Traces, an advocacy and investigation podcast for cold cases. Each season, I investigate one cold case by talking to the family and friends of an unsolved murder victim and to other cold case experts and advocates.
I've compared it to a backpack of bricks that I strapped on when he was killed.
There's a lot of questions that need to be asked that, you know, weren't asked.
This season, I'm investigating the mysterious murder of David Cox. David's time in the Marine Corps was the inspiration for the hit movie A Few Good Men. And shortly after the movie came out, David was mysteriously murdered execution style, and his killer has never been identified. Join me as I speak to those who knew David best. Subscribe to Cold Traces now on your favorite podcast app.